a license to be able to operate a business on the property. The workshop stayed, but Abel kept running it into the ground, drinking his money. At the same time, my mother started moving up at the real estate company she worked for, taking on more responsibilities and earning a better salary. His workshop became like a side hobby almost. He was supposed to pay for Andrew's school fees and groceries, but he started falling behind even on that. And soon, my mom was paying for everything. She paid the electricity. She paid the mortgage. He literally contributed nothing. That was the turning point. When my mother started making more money and getting her independence back, that's when we saw the dragon emerge. The drinking got worse. He grew more and more violent. It wasn't long after coming for me in the pantry that Abel hit my mom for the second time. I can't recall the details of it, because now it's muddled with all the other times that came after it. I do remember that the police were called. They came out to the house this time. But again, it was like a boys' club. "Hey, guys, these women, you know how they are." No report was made. No charges were filed. Whenever he'd hit her or come after me, my mom would find me crying afterward and take me aside. She'd give me the same talk every time. "Pray for Abel," she'd say, "because he doesn't hate us. He hates himself." To a kid, this makes no sense. "Well, if he hates himself," I'd say, "why doesn't he kick himself?" Abel was one of those drinkers where, once he was gone, you'd look into his eyes and you didn't even see the same person. I remember one night, he came home fuck drunk, stumbling through the house. He stumbled into my room, muttering to himself, and I woke up to see him whip out his dick and start pissing on the floor. He thought he was in the bathroom. That's how drunk he would get. He wouldn't know which room in the house he was in. There were so many nights he would stumble into my room, thinking it was his, and kick me out of bed and pass out. I'd yell at him, but it was like talking to a zombie. I'd go sleep on the couch. He'd get wasted with his crew in the backyard every evening after work, and many nights he'd end up fighting with one of them. Someone would say something Abel didn't like, and he'd beat the shit out of them. The guy wouldn't show up for work Tuesday or Wednesday, but then by Thursday he'd be back because he needed the job. Every few weeks it was the same story, like clockwork. Abel kicked the dogs, too. Fufi mostly. Panther was smart enough to stay away, but dumb, lovable Fufi was forever trying to be Abel's friend. She'd cross his path or be in his way when he'd had a few, and he'd give her the boot. After that, she'd go and hide somewhere for a while. Fufi getting kicked was always the warning sign that shit was about to go down. The dogs and the workers in the yard often got the first taste of his anger, and that would let the rest of us know to lie low. I'd usually go find Fufi, wherever she was hiding, and be with her. The strange thing was that when Fufi got kicked, she never yelped or cried. When the vet diagnosed her as deaf, he also found she had some condition where she didn't have a fully developed sense of touch. She didn't feel pain, which was why she would always start over with Abel like it was a new day. He'd kick her, she'd hide, then she'd be right back the next morning, wagging her tail. "Hey, I'm here. I'll give you another chance." And he always got the second chance. The Abel who was likable and charming never went away. He had a drinking problem, but he was a nice guy. We had a family. Growing up in a home of abuse, you struggle with the notion that you can love a person you hate, or hate a person you love. It's a strange feeling. You want to live in a world where someone is good or bad, where you either hate them or love them. But that's not how people are. There was an undercurrent of terror that ran through the house, but the actual beatings themselves were not that frequent. I think if they had been, the situation would have ended sooner. Ironically, the good times in between were what allowed it to drag out and escalate as far as it did. He hit my mom once. Then the next time was 3 years later, and it was just a little bit worse. Then it was 2 years later, and it was just a little bit worse. Then it was a year later, and it was just a little bit worse. It was sporadic enough to where you'd think it wouldn't happen again, but it was frequent enough that you never forgot it was possible. There was a rhythm to it. I remember one time, after one terrible incident, nobody spoke to him for over a month. No words, no eye contact, no conversations, nothing. We moved through the house as strangers, at different times. Complete silent treatment. Then, one morning you're in the kitchen, and there's a nod. Hey, hey. Then a week later it's, did you see that thing on the news? Yeah. Then the next week there's a joke and a laugh. Slowly, slowly, life goes back to how it was. 6 months, a year later, you do it all again. One afternoon, I came home from Sandringham and my mom was very upset and worked up. This man is unbelievable, she said. What happened? He bought a gun. What? A gun? What do you mean he bought a gun? A gun was such a ridiculous thing in my world. In my mind, only cops and criminals had guns. Abel had gone out and bought a 9mm Parabellum Smith & Wesson. Sleek and black. Menacing. It didn't look cool like guns in movies. It looked like it killed things. Why did he buy a gun? I asked. I don't know. She said she'd confronted him about it and he'd gone off on some nonsense about the world needing to learn to respect him. He thinks he's the policeman of the world, she said. And that's the problem with the world. We have people who cannot police themselves, so they want to police everyone else around them. Not long after that, I moved out. The atmosphere had become toxic for me. I'd reached the point where I was as big as Abel, big enough to punch back. A father does not fear retribution from his son, but I was not his son. He knew that. The analogy my mom used was that there were now two male lions in the house. Every time he looks at you, he sees your father, she'd say. You're a constant reminder of another man. He hates you, and you need to leave. You need to leave before you become like him. It was also just time for me to go. Regardless of Abel, our plan had always been for me to move out after school. My mother never wanted me to be like my uncle, one of those men unemployed and still living at home with his mother. She helped me get my flat, and I moved out. The flat was only 10 minutes away from the house, so I was always around to drop in to help with errands or have dinner once in a while. But most important, whatever was going on with Abel, I didn't have to be involved. At some point, my mom moved to a separate bedroom in the house, and from then on, they were married in name only, not even cohabiting but coexisting. That state of affairs lasted a year, maybe two. Andrew had turned 9, and in my world, I was counting down until he turned 18, thinking that would finally free my mom from this abusive man. Then, one afternoon, my mom called and asked me to come by the house. A few hours later, I popped by. Trevor, she said, I'm pregnant. Sorry, what? I'm pregnant. What? Good Lord, I was furious. I was so angry. She herself seemed resolute, as determined as ever, but with an undertone of sadness I had never seen before. Like the news had devastated her at first, but she'd since reconciled herself to the reality of it. How could you let this happen? Abel and I, we made up. I moved back into the bedroom. It was just one night, and then I became pregnant. I don't know how. She didn't know. She was 44 years old. She'd had her tubes tied after Andrew. Even her doctor said, "This shouldn't be possible. We don't know how this happened." I was boiling with rage. All we had to do was wait for Andrew to grow up, and it was going to be over. And now, it was like she'd re-upped on the contract. So you're going to have a child with this man? You're going to stay with this man another 18 years? Are you crazy? God spoke to me, Trevor. He told me, Patricia, I don't do anything by mistake. There's nothing I give you that you cannot handle. I'm pregnant for a reason. I know what kind of kids I can make. I know what kind of sons I can raise. I can raise this child. I will raise this child. 9 months later, Isaac was born. She called him Isaac because in the Bible, Sarah gets pregnant when she's like 100 years old and she's not supposed to be having children, and that's what she names her son. Isaac's birth pushed me even further away. I visited less and less. Then I popped by one afternoon and the house was in chaos. Police cars out front. The aftermath of another fight. He'd hit her with a bicycle. Abel had been berating one of his workers in the yard, and my mom had tried to get between them. Abel was furious that she'd contradicted him in front of an employee, so he picked up Andrew's bike and he beat her with it. Again, she called the police. And the cops who showed up this time actually knew Abel. He'd fixed their cars. They were pals. No charges were filed. Nothing happened. That time, I confronted him. I was big enough now. "You can't keep doing this," I said. "This is not right." He was apologetic. He always was. He didn't puff out his chest and get defensive or anything like that. "I know," he said. "I'm sorry. I don't like doing these things. But you know how your mom is. She can talk a lot, and she doesn't listen. I feel like your mom doesn't respect me sometimes. She came and disrespected me in front of my workers. I can't have these other men looking at me like I don't know how to control my wife." After the bicycle, my mom hired contractors she knew through the real estate business to build her a separate house in the backyard, like a little servant's quarters, and she moved in there with Isaac. "This is the most insane thing I've ever seen," I told her. "This is all I can do," she said. "The police won't help me. The government won't protect me. Only my God can protect me. But what I can do is use against him the one thing that he cherishes, and that is his pride. By me living outside in a shack, everyone is going to ask him, 'Why does your wife live in a shack outside your house?' He's going to have to answer that question, and no matter what he says, everyone will know that something is wrong with him. He loves to live for the world. Let the world see him for who he is. He's a saint in the streets. He's a devil in this house. Let him be seen for who he is." When my mom had decided to keep Isaac, I was so close to writing her off. I couldn't stand the pain anymore. But seeing her hit with a bicycle, living like a prisoner in her own backyard, that was the final straw for me. I was a broken person. I was done. "This thing," I told her, "this dysfunctional thing, I won't be a part of it. I can't live this life with you. I refuse. You've made your decision. Good luck with your life. I'm going to live mine." She understood. She didn't feel betrayed or abandoned at all. "Honey, I know what you're going through," she said. "At one point, I had to disown my family to go off and live my own life too. I understand why you need to do the same." So I did. I walked out. I didn't call. I didn't visit. Isaac came and I went, and for the life of me, I could not understand why she wouldn't do the same. Leave. Just leave. Just fucking leave. I didn't understand what she was going through. I didn't understand domestic violence. I didn't understand how adult relationships worked. I'd never even had a girlfriend. I didn't understand how she could have sex with a man she hated and feared. I didn't know how easily sex and hatred and fear can intertwine. I was angry with my mom. I hated him, but I blamed her. I saw Abel as a choice she'd made, a choice she was continuing to make. My whole life, telling me stories about growing up in the homelands, being abandoned by her parents, she had always said, "You cannot blame anyone else for what you do. You cannot blame your past for who you are. You are responsible for you. You make your own choices." She never let me see us as victims. We were victims. Me and my mom, Andrew and Isaac. Victims of apartheid. Victims of abuse. But I was never allowed to think that way. And I didn't see her life that way. Cutting my father out of our lives to pacify Abel, that was her choice. Supporting Abel's workshop, was her choice. Isaac was her choice. She had the money, not him. She wasn't dependent. So in my mind, she was the one making the decision. It is so easy from the outside to put the blame on the woman and say, you just need to leave. It's not like my home was the only home where there was domestic abuse. It's what I grew up around. I saw it in the streets of Soweto, on TV, in movies. Where does a woman go in a society where that is the norm? When the police won't help her? When her own family won't help her? Where does a woman go when she leaves one man who hits her and is just as likely to wind up with another man who hits her, maybe even worse than the first? Where does a woman go when she's single with three kids and she lives in a society that makes her a pariah for being a manless woman? Where she's seen as a whore for doing that? Where does she go? What does she do? But I didn't comprehend any of that at the time. I was a boy with a boy's understanding of things. I distinctly remember the last time we argued about it too. It was sometime after the bicycle, or when she was moving into her shack in the backyard. I was going off begging her for the 1,000th time. Why? Why don't you just leave? She shook her head. Oh, baby. No, I can't leave. Why not? Because if I leave, he'll kill us. She wasn't being dramatic. She didn't raise her voice. She said it totally calm and matter of fact. And I never asked that question again. Eventually, she did leave. What prompted her to leave? What the final breaking point was? I have no idea. I was gone. I was off becoming a comedian, touring the country, playing shows in England, hosting radio shows, hosting television shows. I'd moved in with my cousin, Mlungisi, and made my own life separate from hers. I couldn't invest myself anymore because it would have broken me into too many pieces. But one day, she bought another house in Highlands North, met someone new, and moved on with her life. Andrew and Isaac still saw their dad, who, by that point, was just existing in the world, still going through the same cycle of drinking and fighting, still living in a house paid for by his ex-wife. Years passed. Life carried on. Then, one morning, I was in bed around 10 a.m., and my phone rang. It was on a Sunday. I know it was a Sunday because everyone else in the family had gone to church, and I, quite happily, had not. The days of endlessly schlepping back and forth to church were no longer my problem, and I was lazily sleeping in. The irony of my life is that whenever church is involved is when shit goes wrong. Like getting kidnapped by violent minibus drivers. I'd always teased my mom about that too. This church thing of yours, all this Jesus, what good has come of it? I looked over at my phone. It was flashing my mom's number. But when I answered, it was Andrew on the other end. He sounded perfectly calm. Hey, Trevor, it's Andrew. Hey, how are you? Good, what's up? Are you busy? I'm sort of sleeping, why? Mom's been shot. Okay, so there were two strange things about the call. First, why would he ask me if I was busy? Let's start there. When your mom's been shot, the first line out of your mouth should be, mom's been shot, not how are you, not are you busy. That confused me. The second weird thing was when he said, mom's been shot. I didn't ask who shot her. I didn't have to. He said, mom's been shot, and my mind automatically filled in the rest. Abel shot mom. Where are you now? I said. We're at Linksfield Hospital. Okay, I'm on my way. I jumped out of bed, ran down the corridor, and banged on Mlungisi's door. Dude, my mom's been shot. She's in the hospital. He jumped out of bed too, and we got in the car and raced to the hospital, which luckily was only 15 minutes away. At that point, I was upset, but not terrified. Andrew had been so calm on the phone, no crying, no panic in his voice, so I was thinking, she must be okay. It must not be that bad. I called him back from the car to find out more. Andrew, what happened? We were on our way home from church, he said, again, totally calm. And Dad was waiting for us at the house, and he got out of his car and started shooting.
But where? Where did he shoot her?
He shot her in the leg.
Oh, okay,
I said, relieved. And then he shot her in the head. When he said that, my body just let go. I remember the exact traffic light I was at. For a moment, there was a complete vacuum of sound, and then I cried tears like I've never cried before. I collapsed in heaving sobs and moans. I cried as if every other thing I'd cried for in my life had been a waste of crying. I cried so hard that if my present crying self could go back in time and see my other crying selves, it would slap them and say, "That shit's not worth crying for." My cry was not a cry of sadness. It was not catharsis. It wasn't me feeling sorry for myself. It was an expression of raw pain that came from an inability of my body to express that pain in any other way, shape, or form. She was my mom. She was my teammate. It had always been me and her together. Me and her against the world. When Andrew said, "Shot her in the head," I broke in two. The light changed. I couldn't even see the road, but I drove through the tears, thinking, just get there, just get there, just get there. We pulled up to the hospital, and I jumped out of the car. There was an outdoor sitting area by the entrance to the emergency room. Andrew was standing there waiting for me, alone, his clothes smeared with blood. He still looked perfectly calm. Completely stoic. Then, the moment he looked up and saw me, he broke down and started bawling. It was like he'd been holding it together the whole morning, and then everything broke loose at once, and he lost it. I ran to him and hugged him, and he cried and cried. His cry was different from mine, though. My cry was one of pain and anger. His cry was one of helplessness. I turned and ran into the emergency room. My mom was there in triage on a gurney. The doctors were stabilizing her. Her whole body was soaked in blood. There was a hole in her face, a gaping wound above her lip, part of her nose gone. She was as calm and serene as I'd ever seen her. She could still open one eye, and she turned and looked up at me and saw the look of horror on my face. "It's okay, baby," she whispered, barely able to speak with the blood in her throat. "It's not okay." "No, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. Where's Andrew? Where's your brother?" "He's outside." "Go to Andrew." "But Mom, shh, it's okay. Baby, I'm fine." "You're not fine. You're, shh, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. Go to your brother. Your brother needs you." The doctors kept working, and there was nothing I could do to help her. I went back outside to be with Andrew. We sat down together, and he told me the story. They were coming home from church, a big group, my mom and Andrew and Isaac, her new husband and his children, and a whole bunch of his extended family, aunts and uncles, nieces and nephews. They had just pulled into the driveway when Abel pulled up and got out of his car. He had his gun. He looked right at my mother. "You've stolen my life," he said. "You've taken everything away from me. Now I'm going to kill all of you." Andrew stepped in front of his father. He stepped right in front of the gun. "Don't do this, Dad, please. You're drunk. Just put the gun away." Abel looked down at his son. "No," he said. "I'm killing everybody. And if you don't walk away, I will shoot you first." Andrew stepped aside. "His eyes were not lying," he told me. "He had the eyes of the devil. In that moment, I could tell my father was gone." For all the pain I felt that day, in hindsight, I have to imagine that Andrew's pain was far greater than mine. My mom had been shot by a man I despised. If anything, I felt vindicated. I'd been right about Abel all along. I could direct my anger and hatred toward him with no shame or guilt whatsoever. But Andrew's mother had been shot by Andrew's father. a father he loved. How does he reconcile his love with that situation? How does he carry on loving both sides of himself? Isaac was only 4 years old. He didn't fully comprehend what was happening, and as Andrew stepped aside, Isaac started crying.
Daddy, what are you doing? Daddy, what are you doing?
Isaac, go to your brother,
Abel said. Isaac ran over to Andrew, and Andrew held him. Then Abel raised his gun, and he started shooting. My mother jumped in front of the gun to protect everyone, and that's when she took the first bullet. Not in her leg, but in her butt cheek. She collapsed, and as she fell to the ground, she screamed, "Run!" Abel kept shooting, and everyone ran. They scattered. My mom was struggling to get back to her feet when Abel walked up and stood over her. He pointed the gun at her head, point blank, execution style. Then he pulled the trigger. Nothing. The gun misfired. Click. He pulled the trigger again. Same thing. Then again and again. Click, 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 click. 4 times he pulled the trigger, and 4 times the gun misfired. Bullets were popping out of the ejection port, falling out of the gun, falling down on my mom and clattering to the ground. Abel stopped to see what was wrong with the gun. My mother jumped up in a panic. She shoved him aside, ran for the car, jumped into the driver's seat. Andrew ran behind and jumped into the passenger seat next to her. Just as she turned the ignition, Andrew heard one last gunshot, and the windshield went red. Abel had fired from behind the car. The bullets went into the back of her head and exited through the front of her face, and blood sprayed everywhere. Her body slumped over the steering wheel. Andrew, reacting without thinking, pulled my mom to the passenger side, flipped over her, jumped into the driver's seat, slammed the car into gear, and raced to the hospital in Lingsfield. I asked Andrew what happened to Abel. He didn't know. I was filled with rage, but there was nothing I could do. I felt completely impotent, but I still felt I had to do something. So I took out my phone and I called him. I called the man who just shot my mom, and he actually picked up.
Trevor,
you killed my mom.
Yes, I did.
You killed my mom.
Yes, and if I could find you, I would kill you as well.
Then he hung up. It was the most chilling moment. It was terrifying. Whatever nerve I'd worked up to call him, I immediately lost. To this day, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what I expected to happen. I was just enraged. I kept asking Andrew questions, trying to get more details. Then, as we were talking, a nurse came outside looking for me.
"Are you the family?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Sir, there's a problem. Your mother was speaking a bit at first. She stopped now, but from what we've gathered, she doesn't have health insurance."
"What?
No, no, that can't be true. I know my mom has health insurance."
She didn't. As it turned out, a few months prior, she'd decided, "This health insurance is a scam. I never get sick. I'm going to cancel it." So now, she had no health insurance.
"We can't treat your mother here," the nurse said. "If she doesn't have insurance, we have to send her to a state hospital."
"State hospital?
What? No, you can't. My mom's been shot in the head. You're going to put her back on a gurney? Send her out in an ambulance? She'll die. You need to treat her right now."
"Sir, we can't. We need a form of payment."
"I'm your form of payment. I'll pay."
"Yes, people say that, but without a guarantee..."
I pulled out my credit card.
"Here," I said. "Take this. I'll pay. I'll pay for everything."
"Sir, hospital can be very expensive."
"I don't care."
"Sir, I don't think you understand. Hospital can be really expensive."
"Lady, I have money. I'll pay anything. Just help us."
"Sir, you don't understand. We have to do so many tests. One test alone could cost 2,000-3,000 rand.
3,000? What? Lady, this is my mother's life we're talking about. I'll pay."
"Sir, you don't understand. Your mother has been shot in her brain. She'll be in the ICU. One night in ICU could cost you 15,000-20,000 rand.
"Lady, Are you not listening to me? This is my mother's life. This is her life. Take the money. Take all of it. I don't care. Sir, you don't understand. I've seen this happen. Your mother could be in the ICU for weeks. This could cost you 500,000, 600,000, maybe even millions. You'll be in debt for the rest of your life. I'm not going to lie to you. I paused. I paused hard in that moment. What I heard the nurse saying was, all of your money will be gone. And then I started to think, well, what is she, 50? That's pretty good, right? She's lived a good life. I genuinely did not know what to do. I stared at the nurse as the shock of what she'd said sunk in. My mind raced through a dozen different scenarios. What if I spend that money and then she dies anyway? Do I get a refund? I actually imagined my mother, as frugal as she was, waking up from a coma and saying, "You spent how much? You idiot! You should have saved that money to look after your brothers." And what about my brothers? They would be my responsibility now. I would have to raise the family, which I couldn't do if I was millions in debt. And it was always my mother's solemn vow that raising my brother was the one thing I would never have to do. Even as my career took off, she refused any help I offered. "I don't want you paying for your mother the same way I had to pay for mine," she'd say. "I don't want you raising your brothers the same way Abel had to raise his." My mother's greatest fear was that I would end up paying the black tax, that I would get trapped by the cycle of poverty and violence that came before me. She had always promised me that I would be the one to break the cycle. I would be the one to move forward and not back. And as I looked at that nurse outside the emergency room, I was petrified that the moment I handed her my credit card, the cycle would just continue and I'd get sucked right back in. People say all the time that they'd do anything for the people they love. But would you really? Would you do anything? Would you give everything? I don't know that a child knows that kind of selfless love. A mother, yes. A mother will clutch her children and jump from a moving car to keep them from harm. She will do it without thinking. But I don't think the child knows how to do that. Not instinctively. It's something the child has to learn. I pressed my credit card into the nurse's hand. "Do whatever you have to do. Just please help my mom." We spent the rest of the day in limbo, waiting, not knowing, pacing around the hospital, family members stopping by. Several hours later, the doctor finally came out of the emergency room to give us an update. "What's happening?" I asked. "Your mother is stable," he said. "She's out of surgery." "Is she going to be okay?" He thought for a moment about what he was going to say. "I don't like to use this word," he said, "because I'm a man of science and I don't believe in it. But what happened to your mother today was a miracle. I never say that because I hate it when people say it, but I don't have any other way to explain this." "The bullet that hit my mother in the butt," he said, "was a through and through. It went in, came out, and didn't do any real damage. The other bullet went through the back of her head, entering below the skull at the top of her neck. It missed the spinal cord by a hair, missed the medulla oblongata, and traveled through her head just underneath the brain, missing every major vein, artery, and nerve. With the trajectory the bullet was on, it was headed straight for her left eye socket, and it would have blown her eye out. But at the last second, it slowed down, hit her cheekbone instead, shattered her cheekbone, ricocheted off, and came out through her left nostril. On the gurney, in the emergency room, the blood had made the wound look much worse than it was. The bullet took off only a tiny flap of skin on the side of her nostril, and it came out clean, with no bullet fragments left inside. She didn't even need surgery. They stopped the bleeding, stitched her up in back, stitched her up in front, and let her heal. "There was nothing we can do because there's nothing we need to do," the doctor said. My mother was out of the hospital in 4 days. She was back at work in 7.
The doctors kept her sedated the rest of that day and night to rest. They told all of us to go home. "She's stable," they said. "There's nothing you can do here. Go home and sleep." So we did. I went back first thing the next morning to be with my mother in her room and wait for her to wake up. When I walked in, she was still asleep. The back of her head was bandaged. She had stitches in her face and gauze covering her nose and her left eye. She looked frail and weak, tired. One of the few times in my life I'd ever seen her look that way. I sat close by her bed, holding her hand, waiting and watching her breathe, a flood of thoughts going through my mind. I was still afraid I was going to lose her. I was angry at myself for not being there, angry at the police for all the times they didn't arrest Abel. I told myself I should have killed him years ago, which was ridiculous to think because I'm not capable of killing anyone. But I thought it anyway. I was angry at the world, angry at God, because all my mom does is pray. If there's a fan club for Jesus, my mom is definitely in the top 100. And this is what she gets? After an hour or so of waiting, she opened her unbandaged eye. The second she did, I lost it. I started bawling. She asked for some water, and I gave her a cup, and she leaned forward a bit to sip through the straw. I kept bawling and bawling and bawling. I couldn't control myself. "Shh," she said. "Don't cry, baby. Shh, don't cry." "How can I not cry, Mom? You almost died." "No, I wasn't going to die. I wasn't going to die. It's okay. I wasn't going to die." "But I thought you were dead." I kept bawling and bawling. "I thought I'd lost you." "No, baby. Baby, don't cry. Trevor, Trevor, listen. Listen to me. Listen." "What?" I said, tears streaming down my face. "My child, you must look on the bright side." "What? What are you talking about, the bright side? Mom, you were shot in the face. There's no bright side." "Of course there is. Now, you're officially the best-looking person in the family." She broke out in a huge smile and started laughing. Through my tears, I started laughing too. I was bawling my eyes out and laughing hysterically at the same time. We sat there and she squeezed my hand. And we cracked each other up the way we always did, mother and son, laughing together through the pain in an intensive care recovery room on a bright and sunny and beautiful day. When my mother was shot, so much happened so quickly. We were only able to piece the whole story together after the fact, as we collected all the different accounts from everyone who was there. Waiting around at the hospital that day, we had so many unanswered questions, like, what happened to Isaac? Where was Isaac? We only found out after we found him, and he told us. When Andrew sped off with my mom, leaving the 4-year-old alone on the front lawn, Abel walked over to his youngest, picked him up, put the boy in his car, and drove away. As they drove, Isaac turned to his dad. "Dad, why did you kill Mom?" he asked, at that point assuming, as we all did, that my mom was dead. "Because I'm very unhappy," Abel replied. "Because I'm very sad."
"Yeah, but you shouldn't kill Mom. Where are we going now?"
"I'm going to drop you off at your uncle's house."
"And where are you going?"
"I'm going to kill myself."
"But don't kill yourself, Dad."
"No, I'm going to kill myself." The uncle Abel was talking about was not a real uncle, but a friend. He dropped Isaac off with his friend, and then he drove off. He spent that day and went to everyone, relatives and friends, and said his goodbyes. He even told people what he had done. "This is what I've done. I've killed her. And I'm now on the way to kill myself. Goodbye." He spent the whole day on this strange farewell tour, until finally, one of his cousins called him out. "You need to man up," the cousin said. "This is the coward's way. You need to turn yourself in. If you were man enough to do this, you have to be man enough to face the consequences." Abel broke down and handed his gun over to the cousin,
The cousin drove him to the police station, and Abel turned himself in. He spent a couple of weeks in jail, waiting for a bail hearing. We filed a motion opposing bail because he'd shown that he was a threat. Since Andrew and Isaac were still minors, social workers started getting involved. We felt like the case was open and shut. But then one day, after a month or so, we got a call that he'd made bail. The great irony was that he got bail because he told the judge that if he was in jail, he couldn't earn money to support his kids. But he wasn't supporting his kids. My mom was supporting the kids. So Abel was out. The case slowly ground its way through the legal system, and everything went against us. Because of my mother's miraculous recovery, the charge was only attempted murder. And because no domestic violence charges had ever been filed in all the times my mother had called the police to report him, Abel had no criminal record. He got a good lawyer who continued to lean on the court about the fact that he had children at home who needed him. The case never went to trial. Abel pled guilty to attempted murder. He was given 3 years probation. He didn't serve a single day in prison. He kept joint custody of his sons. He's walking around Johannesburg today, completely free. The last I heard, he still lives somewhere around Highlands North, not too far from my mom. The final piece of the story came from my mom, who could only tell us her side after she woke up. She remembered Abel pulling up and pointing the gun at Andrew. She remembered falling to the ground after getting shot in the ass. Then Abel came and stood over her and pointed his gun at her head. She looked up and looked at him straight down the barrel of the gun. Then she started to pray, and that's when the gun misfired. Then it misfired again, then it misfired again and again. She jumped up, shoved him away, and ran for the car. Andrew leapt in beside her, and she turned the ignition, and then her memory went blank. To this day, nobody can explain what happened. Even the police didn't understand, because it wasn't like the gun didn't work. It fired, and then it didn't fire, and then it fired again for the final shot. Anyone who knows anything about firearms will tell you that a 9mm handgun cannot misfire in the way that gun did. But at the crime scene, the police had drawn little chalk circles all over the driveway, all with spent shell casings from the shots Abel fired. And then, these 4 bullets, intact, from when he was standing over my mom. Nobody knows why. My mom's total hospital bill came to 50,000 rand. I paid it the day we left. For 4 days, we'd been in the hospital. Family members visiting, talking and hanging out, laughing and crying. As we packed up her things to leave, I was going on about how insane the whole week had been. "You're lucky to be alive," I told her. "I still can't believe you didn't have any health insurance." "Oh, but I do have health insurance," she said.
"You do?"
"Yes. Jesus."
"Jesus?"
"Jesus.
Jesus is your health insurance?"
"If God is with me, who can be against me?"
"Okay, Mom."
"Trevor, I prayed. I told you I prayed. I don't pray for nothing." "You know," I said, "for once, I cannot argue with you. The gun, the bullets, I can't explain any of it. So I'll give you that much." Then I couldn't resist teasing her with one last little jab. "But where was your Jesus to pay your hospital bill? I know for a fact that he didn't pay that." She smiled and said, "You're right, he didn't. But he blessed me with the son who did."
This has been an Audible Studios production of Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood. Written and performed by Trevor Noah. Executive producers, Keith O'Connell and Mike Charzik. Producer, Neil Basic. Edited by Brian Corcoran. Mixed and mastered by Darren Vermas. Copyright 2016 by Trevor Noah. Production copyright 2016 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.